Hello, this is Jane from the Talking Information Center. Today we will be reading from the Wednesday, April 8th, 2026 edition of Reuters News. Intelligence report warned of Iran's persistent threat to the U.S. as White House downplayed the risk. By Christina Cook and Ted Hessen. The FBI warned U.S. state and local law enforcement of an elevated threat posed by Iran's government to targets in the United States last month, even as the White House sought to downplay the likelihood of an attack, a law enforcement intelligence report reviewed by Reuters shows. In the March 20th report, the FBI and other federal intelligence agencies cautioned that Iranian government poses a persistent threat to U.S. military and government personnel and buildings, Jewish and Israeli institutions, and Iranian dissidents in the U.S. Despite those warnings, the FBI and National Counterterrorism Center had not identified broad threats to the American public, the report said. President Donald Trump publicly has minimized the possibility of Iranian attacks on American soil in response to other intelligence assessments in recent months. When asked outside the White House on March 11th whether he was worried about Iran perpetrating an attack in the U.S., Trump said, "No, I'm not." The Republican president escalated his rhetoric around the conflict this week, saying on Tuesday that a whole civilization will die tonight if Iran did not meet his demands, but later delaying the threatened assault by 2 weeks. The March 20th report, titled Public Safety Awareness Report, was issued weeks after Reuters and other news outlets reported that the White House blocked the release of a similarly described intelligence product. At the time, the White House said it was ensuring any information was properly vetted before release. The entire Trump administration is working together to protect the homeland and the American people, as they always do, White House spokeswoman Abigail Jackson said in a statement. Media outlets should not attempt to irresponsibly sow fear by reporting on individual law enforcement memorandums that may lack broader context. The FBI and NCTC did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Ali Karimi Magam, a spokesperson for the Iranian mission to the United Nations, also declined to comment. Most Americans oppose the war and want a quick end. Americans have had negative views of the war, with two-thirds saying the U.S. should end its involvement quickly, a Reuters Ipsos poll found last month, making the public perception of any threat especially relevant. The March 20th FBI report was obtained through open records requests by the National Security Transparency nonprofit Property of the People and shared with Reuters. The report highlighted the potential for elevated physical threats to targets in the U.S. by the Iranian government following the start of the conflict. Violent extremists with a variety of ideological backgrounds, including those who oppose the U.S. or Israel, also may see this conflict as a justification for violence, the report stated. The report said Iranian security services have attempted to kidnap and kill Americans in recent years. While it says most plots in the U.S. have involved firearms, other methods included stabbings, vehicle rammings, bombings, poisoning, strangling, suffocation, and arson. Tehran prefers to use operatives with existing U.S. legal status or access to the U.S., the report said. The Iranian government in the past has monitored social media, live streams, and map applications to choose targets and assess security measures, the report said, adding that the government also used hacking tactics such as phishing emails. The Iranian government also has attempted to lure victims to other countries geographically closer to Iran, almost certainly for kidnapping and eventual executions, it said. The report warned law enforcement officials should remain vigilant to possible threats and share concerning information with federal authorities. DHS says the U.S. could stop processing international travelers at some airports in sanctuary cities. By David Shepherdson and Ted Hessen. Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen said on Tuesday that customs officials could stop processing international travelers at major U.S. airports and sanctuary cities that have declined to cooperate with the Trump administration's hardline immigration crackdown, a move that could severely impact U.S. trade and tourism. The move could effectively halt international air travel and commerce at major airports in democratic states and have major ramifications for the FIFA World Cup that is set to start in early June. More than 50 million international travelers arrived at the three major New York airports alone last year. The U.S. Department of Justice published a list of so-called sanctuary cities and states in October 2025 that included many cities with major international airports, such as Denver, Philadelphia, Chicago, Los Angeles, New York City, Newark, Seattle, and San Francisco. U.S. airports and immigration enforcement have been at the center of a partisan funding fight since mid-February, when Democrats refused to support additional money for President Donald Trump's immigration crackdown without reforms to scale back aggressive tactics. Mullen cited the ongoing refusal of Democrats to reach a deal to fund the Department of Homeland Security, including Customs and Border Protection, and said he anticipated speaking with Trump about the idea of pulling customs offices. "It's an option," Mullen told reporters in North Carolina, adding no decision had been made. "If cities are going to sit there and say that they're not going to enforce immigration policies, then I'll repeat myself and say it doesn't make any sense for us to process international travelers through that city." Mullen said pulling the customs officers was one of several options under consideration as Congress remains deadlocked over funding for DHS. "We're going to start having those conversations. As I said, this is just something I'm thinking. This isn't something that I'm necessarily going to do," he said. Mullen argued that state and city policies and laws limiting immigration enforcement were illegal because they contradicted federal immigration laws. ICE arrested more than 800 people after tips from U.S. Airport Security Agency, by Ted Hessen and Christina Cook. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested more than 800 people following tips shared by federal airport security officials from the start of Donald Trump's presidency through February 2026, internal ICE data reviewed by Reuters show, a figure far above what was previously publicly known. The leads came from the Transportation Security Administration, which supplied ICE with records on more than 31,000 travelers for possible immigration enforcement, the data showed. Reuters could not determine how many arrests took place inside airports, although the TSA tips would mainly be useful in determining when a person would be traveling. ICE and TSA are part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The agencies have historically shared information related to national security threats, but they began focusing on routine immigration arrests last year as part of Trump's mass deportation effort. The TSA program was designed to counter terrorism. The 31,000 traveler records were gathered by TSA's Secure Flight Program, which was created in 2007 to allow the agency to review passenger information for people who may be on U.S. government watch lists. The program was intended as a counterterrorism measure, not to track down immigration offenders, according to the regulation outlining its purpose. DHS did not respond to questions about TSA providing passenger information to ICE, but said that under Trump, TSA is pursuing solutions that improve resiliency, security, and efficiency across our entire system. Figures for arrests and traveler records that TSA shared with ICE before Trump's current term were unavailable. U.S. airports and immigration enforcement have been at the center of a partisan funding fight since mid-February, when Democrats refused to support additional money for the Republican president's immigration crackdown without reforms to scale back aggressive tactics. The standoff blocked the passage of a bill to fund DHS, which caused TSA security officers to miss at least two full paychecks. After some unpaid TSA officers began calling in sick, Trump deployed ICE officers to more than a dozen airports in March to aid security efforts. Democrats have criticized the deployment and called on the Trump administration to remove them. A group of more than 40 Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives wrote in a letter to recently installed Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen last week that ICE officers will cause confusion and fear if allowed to remain in airports. Reports of unexpected airport arrests. Several cases of ICE officers arresting travelers in U.S. airports have sparked backlash. ICE officers detained a college student traveling from Boston to Texas to celebrate Thanksgiving in November and arrested a sobbing mother at San Francisco International Airport the day before Trump's airport deployment began. DHS defended both arrests and said they were subject to final orders of removal. Reuters spoke with three immigration attorneys who said they were familiar with cases of people without legal immigration status being arrested in airports. The cases included an Irish couple who had lived in the U.S. for more than two decades and were detained last summer by immigration authorities in front of their children when trying to fly from Florida to New York after a vacation, Christina Canty, one of the lawyers, said. The parents, who had pending applications for permanent residency, were deported and left their two young children, ages 7 and 10, with adult siblings in the U.S., Canty said. In another case, a Chinese woman with a final order of removal who was seeking permanent residence was detained by ICE last year at the Atlanta airport en route to Philadelphia, one of the attorneys said. Traders place large $950 million bet on oil price falling hours ahead of the ceasefire. By Amanda Cooper, Alex Lawler, and Ahmad Gadar. From London, investors placed an approximately $950 million bet on oil prices falling just hours before the U.S. and Iran announced a ceasefire, the latest large wager on the direction of the world's most traded commodity, ahead of a major policy announcement by President Donald Trump. On Tuesday, investors sold a combined 8,600 lots of Brent and U.S. crude futures at 1945 Greenwich Mean Time, according to LSEG data. At around 2230 Greenwich Mean Time on Tuesday, Trump stepped back from threatening the destruction of a whole civilization and announced a two-week ceasefire with Iran, knocking crude futures down by some 15% to below $100 a barrel at the start of Wednesday's official trading session. Taking large positions on oil prices falling or rising is not unusual, as traders use them to hedge large volumes of physical oil trade. But such deals are rarely done in big lots, as traders prefer to use sweeping orders across many exchanges and ask brokers to use algorithmic trading over many hours to execute the order to avoid impacting prices with their bets. Large orders also are seldom executed after settlement, which happens Monday to Friday at 18:30 Greenwich Mean Time. The bet follows similar moves on March 23rd, when investors sold $500 million in oil futures just 15 minutes before an announcement by Trump that he would delay attacks on Iran's energy infrastructure, which stunned markets and then triggered a 15% drop in the crude price. In Tuesday's trading, some 6,200 lots of Brent futures changed hands at 1945 GMT, roughly 1% of the total volume traded in the day's regular session, while some 2,400 lots of WTI futures traded at this time, also equal to around 1% of that day's regular volume. CME Group declined to comment. ICE did not immediately respond to a Reuters request for comment. Trading volumes and volatility have exploded since the start of the war. On average, in the 3 years leading up to the war, some 300,000 lots of Brent crude futures would change hands on a daily basis. That amount has doubled in the last 4 weeks, as daily volumes have hit record highs above 1 million lots, equal to 1 billion barrels of oil. Wall Street jumps to near one-month highs as U.S.-Iran ceasefire improves sentiment. By Purvi Agarwal and Avinash P. Wall Street's main indices climbed to near one-month highs on Wednesday after the U.S. and Iran agreed to a two-week ceasefire, sending crude prices lower on expectations that energy supplies through the Strait of Hormuz could resume. The announcement came hours before U.S. President Donald Trump's deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the waterway that carries about one-fifth of global oil trade. A senior Iranian official told Reuters that the passage could be opened on Thursday or Friday ahead of peace talks if the countries agreed upon a framework for the ceasefire. Global markets, which had been reeling under conflicting signals for weeks, staged a rally, with stock bourses in Asia and Europe rising, while crude prices slid below $100 a barrel. Whether these early risk-on moves are sustainable or not is another matter. If shipping starts to move through the Strait of Hormuz again and there's strong evidence that things can return to pre-war normality, that will embolden investors, said David Morrison, senior market analyst at Trade Nation. But given the complexity of the issues around this, a two-week ceasefire is unlikely to be sufficient to convince investors that it's safe to go back in the water. At 10.06 a.m. Eastern Time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 1,308.99 points to 47,893 spot 45. The S&P 500 gained 155.91 points to 6,772 spot 76, and the NASDAQ Composite gained 617.51 points to 22,635 spot 36. The small-cap Russell 2000 index jumped 3% to a more than one-month high, while the CBOE Volatility Index slumped 4.74 points to 20.99 after hitting its lowest point since February of 2007. The S&P 500 energy sector was the only one in the red, down almost 5%. ExxonMobil shed 6.3%, Chevron dropped 5.5%, and Occidental Petroleum lost 7.7%. Travel-linked stocks jumped, with Southwest Airlines and United Airlines advancing 10.8% and 12.8% respectively. They boosted industrial stocks on the S&P 500 by 3.8%, the top gainers. Cruise operators Carnival and Norwegian Cruise Line added 14.2% and 12% respectively. The S&P 500 tech index rose 2.8%, helped by chip-linked stocks. The Philadelphia SE Semiconductor Index briefly hit a record high, last up 5.3%. Dow was lifted by gains in Goldman Sachs and American Express. This week, domestic inflation readings will be scrutinized for signs of whether the elevated crude prices during the war have added to price pressures. Comments from Federal Reserve officials and minutes from its March meeting will also be parsed. Market bets show a 33.9% chance of a 25 basis point cut in December, according to CME's FedWatch tool, up from 13.6% a day ago. Traders expected two cuts before the war broke out. Among other movers, Levi Strauss gained 12.8% after the denim apparel maker raised its annual sales and profit forecasts. Delta Airlines advanced 8.6% in line with peers, despite forecasting lower than expected profit for the second quarter. It also did not update its annual outlook due to uncertainty over fuel prices linked to the Iran war. Advancing issues outnumbered decliners by a 6.7-to-1 ratio on the New York Stock Exchange and by a 5.53-to-1 ratio on the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 posted 18 new 52-week highs and no new lows, while the NASDAQ Composite recorded 108 new highs and 17 new lows. Acting DOJ Chief Blanche says Trump has the right to influence investigations. By Andrew Gadsworth. Acting U.S. Attorney General Todd Blanche said on Tuesday that President Donald Trump has a right and duty to shape federal probes of individuals who investigated him as he faces pressure from the president to deliver prosecutions of perceived enemies. In his first extended comments since being named acting attorney general last week, Blanche bristled at the notion that the Justice Department has been improperly targeting Trump's opponents, but defended the president's authority to influence investigations. "We have thousands of ongoing investigations and prosecutions going on in this country right now. It is true that some of them involve men, women, and entities that the president in the past has had issues with and believes should be investigated. That is his right, and indeed it is his duty to do that," meaning to lead this country, Blanche said during a press conference. Trump fired former Attorney General Pam Bondi on Thursday, in part over dissatisfaction with the pace and outcome of cases that Trump has demanded. "I love you, sir. The Justice Department under Trump has opened a slew of investigations into Trump's adversaries, including U.S. officials who concluded that Russia interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential election to boost Trump's first campaign, Democratic lawmakers who urged U.S. military personnel to refuse unlawful orders, and liberal donors and fundraising groups. The DOJ has encountered obstacles from judges and grand juries in many of those investigations. A federal judge last year dismissed cases against two officials who investigated Trump, James Comey and Letitia James. Blanche, who represented Trump in three of the four criminal cases he faced during his years out of office, pointed to those cases in arguing that Trump wants justice for those whom he believes improperly turned the legal system against him. Blanche declined to say on Tuesday whether he wants to be nominated to the vacant attorney general post. He said the decision was up to Trump, and if the president nominated someone else and asked Blanche to leave his role in the Justice Department, quote, "I will say, thank you very much. I love you, sir." End quote. The ketamine queen to be sentenced in the death of Friends star Matthew Perry. By Lisa Richbein. From Los Angeles. A drug dealer known as the ketamine queen is scheduled to be sentenced on Wednesday for illegally supplying the dose of the prescription anesthetic that led to the drowning death of Friends actor Matthew Perry. Jasveen Sanga, 42, pleaded guilty in September to five felony counts related to Perry's death in his hot tub in 2023. Federal prosecutors argue that Sanga should be sentenced to 15 years in prison. While the defendant worked to expand and profit from her drug trafficking, she knew and disregarded the grave harm her conduct was causing, prosecutors said in court documents. Defense attorneys are advocating for a sentence of time served, telling a judge in a court filing that Sanga has taken responsibility for her actions and worked to rehabilitate herself. Sanga, who they said has a history of substance abuse, has been in prison since August of 2024. She has maintained, sustained, and exemplary sobriety and actively engaged in recovery-oriented and rehabilitative programming while in custody, her attorneys said. Ketamine, a short-acting anesthetic with hallucinogenic properties, is prescribed to treat depression and anxiety, but it has also gained popularity as an illicit party drug among recreational users. Medical examiners concluded that Perry died from acute effects of ketamine, which combined with other factors to cause the actor to lose consciousness and drown in a hot tub at his Los Angeles home. The actor was 54 years old. Perry had publicly acknowledged decades of substance abuse, including periods that overlapped with the height of his fame, playing the sardonic but charming Chandler Bing on the 1990s hit NBC television comedy Friends. Sanga, a dual U.S.-British citizen, admitted to supplying 51 vials of ketamine to a go-between dealer, Eric Fleming, who in turn sold the doses to Perry through his live-in personal assistant, Kenneth Iwamasa. Sanga said she had been aware that vials she sold were intended for Perry. "It was Iwamasa prosecutors said, who later injected Perry with at least 3 shots of ketamine from the vials Sangha supplied, resulting in the actor's death. Fleming and Iwamasa have pleaded guilty and are scheduled to be sentenced later this month. Iran's Araghchi, seen as the country's most powerful foreign minister yet, by Parisa Hafizi and Leila Bassam. From Dubai, the son of an Iranian carpet merchant from Isfahan, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, who will accompany the parliament speaker in peace talks with the United States in Pakistan, has compared the country's negotiating style to the bartering of the bazaar, an approach requiring patience and great time. Iranian and U.S. officials are expected to hold talks on Friday to discuss a long-term settlement after the longtime foes agreed on a Pakistan-brokered 2-week ceasefire to suspend a 6-week-old war that has killed thousands, spread across the Middle East, and caused unprecedented disruption to the world's energy supplies. Tehran said the Iranian delegation, led by influential former commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, Mohammad Bakir Khalibaf, will enter peace talks with caution, citing a deep trust deficit with Washington. Late Supreme Leader picked Araghchi to lead previous talks. Israel removed Araghchi and Khalibaf from its hit list after Pakistan urged Washington to press Israel not to target them, a Pakistani source told Reuters last month, making them some of the few top figures left that could negotiate with the United States after scores of Iran's senior political and military officials were targeted during the war. Araghchi, Iran's top diplomat since 2024, was picked by Iran's late supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, to lead several rounds of talks with U.S. Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff in efforts to resolve Tehran's long-standing nuclear dispute with the West. Talks mediated by Oman stalled on core issues from uranium enrichment to missiles and sanctions relief. The mild-mannered diplomat played a key role in years of negotiations that led to Tehran's 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, the agreement that was torn up by Trump in 2018 during his first term. Political insiders have described the British-educated Araghchi as one of the Islamic Republic's most powerful foreign ministers yet. Iran's clerical establishment appears confident in his ability to play its hand with deftness and guile. Writing in his 2024 book, The Power of Negotiation, Araghchi noted that the Iranians' negotiating approach was commonly referred to as the style of the bazaar, meaning continuous and persistent bargaining. He described in a footnote memories of his late mother's bartering skill. But he also cautioned against overplaying your hand. When you sell snow under the sun, bargaining more than necessary is a loss, he wrote, in an Arabic translation of the book. Araghchi cultivated a reputation as a master of tough negotiation during the talks over Iran's nuclear program over a decade ago. Under that deal, Iran agreed tight restrictions on its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Western diplomats involved in those talks have described him as serious, technically knowledgeable, and straightforward. Araghchi joined Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution as a teenager and fought in the 1980s Iran-Iraq War before embarking on a diplomatic career. An insider who has known Araghchi for years said he is calm and patient, yet combative and resilient. Keeps distance from political frays and infighting. Araghchi was the point man for ultimately unsuccessful efforts to resurrect the 2015 deal during U.S. President Joe Biden's 2021-25 administration until he was replaced with a hardliner. Soon afterwards, he was named Secretary of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, a key body advising the Supreme Leader, pulling him into the inner orbit of Iran's ultimate authority. Born in Tehran in 1962 to a wealthy religious merchant family, Araghchi was only 17 when the Islamic Revolution washed over Iran and filled many of its youth with radical fervor. Inspired by the ousting of the U.S.-backed Shah's dynastic regime and the promise of a new future, he enlisted in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Iran's military vanguard, to fight in the 1980-88 war with Iraq. He joined the foreign ministry in 1989 and served as ambassador in Finland from 1999 to 2003 and Japan from 2007 to 2011, before becoming foreign ministry spokesman in 2013. He obtained a doctorate in politics from the University of Kent in Britain and was appointed to deputy foreign minister in 2013. A devout Muslim, Araghchi has served under presidents whose instincts have ranged from pragmatic to hardline. Despite being a political insider with close ties to Khomeini, Araghchi has kept himself distant from political frays and infighting between factions, and he maintained good relations with the powerful Revolutionary Guards and all factions in Iran, according to a senior Iranian official. What the U.S., Iran, Israel, and Pakistan have said about the ceasefire. The United States, Israel, and Iran have agreed to a two-week ceasefire, reached with Pakistani mediation, and U.S. and Iranian officials are expected to hold talks on Friday to discuss a long-term settlement. While Tehran and Washington have agreed to talks, Iran's 10-point proposals, which U.S. President Donald Trump said offered a workable basis for negotiations, showed little overlap with a 15-point plan Washington previously put forward, suggesting there will be major gaps to bridge. For example, Iran's proposal includes a demand to enrich uranium, which Washington previously ruled out. The 10 points also do not address Iran's missile capabilities, which Israel and the U.S. have both said must be dramatically curtailed. Below are what each side involved has said so far about the ceasefire deal. What did the Pakistani mediators say? Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif announced the ceasefire between Iran and the United States on X, saying the two sides agreed to an immediate ceasefire everywhere, including Lebanon, where Israel launched strikes. The Prime Minister did not mention either Iran's 10-point proposals or the U.S. 15-point plan, and his statement made no mention of any agreement with Israel. One Pakistani official in the region said Iran could expect to secure many of its demands with a focus on reconstruction, reparations, and sanctions relief, but could not expect to secure an agreement on uranium enrichment. What did Trump say, and what were the past U.S. proposals? In a post on his Truth Social, Trump said U.S. forces would suspend strikes on Iran for 2 weeks, subject to the Islamic Republic agreeing to, quote, the complete, immediate, and safe opening of the Strait of Hormuz, end quote. He said the two sides were very far along with a definitive agreement concerning long-term peace with Iran and peace in the Middle East. While he said Iran's 10-point proposal provided a workable basis for talks, he did not list their points and said major issues of past contention had been agreed. According to Israeli sources, Trump's 15-point proposal previously sent to Iran via Pakistan called for removing Iran's stock of highly enriched uranium, halting enrichment, curbing its ballistic missile program, and cutting off funding for regional allies. What is Iran's position? Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said in a statement that Iran agreed to halt what it termed offensive operations if attacks on Iran were halted, based on the U.S. request for talks grounded in Washington's 15-point proposal and Trump's agreement to use Iran's 10-point plan as a basis for negotiations. He said safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz would be possible for 2 weeks via coordination with Iran's armed forces and with due consideration of technical limitations. Iran's Supreme National Security Council said in a statement that Washington had agreed to accept Iran's 10-point plan and that the United States has, in principle, committed to bullet points: non-aggression, continued Iranian control over the state of Hormuz, acceptance of enrichment, lifting all primary and secondary sanctions, termination of all resolutions passed by the UN Security Council and Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency, withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from the region, and cessation of war on all fronts, including against the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. Before the ceasefire deal, a senior Iranian official had said Iran would demand transit fees for ships to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, which is considered an international waterway. What have the Israelis said? Israel said it had agreed to a ceasefire with Iran, but said the deal did not include halting military action in Lebanon. An Israeli official said the U.S. coordinated the temporary ceasefire with Israel in advance, adding that Iran had agreed to opening the Strait of Hormuz without a commitment to a final end to the war, compensation, lifting sanctions, and more. The official also said the Trump administration had informed Israel that during talks with Iran over the next 2 weeks, the U.S. would insist on the removal of nuclear material, a halt to enrichment, and elimination of the ballistic missile threat, in addition to addressing other issues. Amazon strikes deal with the United States Postal Service that maintains 80% of package volume, by Dave Shepherdson and Jacob Bogash. Amazon.com on Monday announced it reached a new agreement with the U.S. Postal Service on package deliveries, and sources said the cash-strapped mail system would retain about 80% of its existing deliveries from its biggest customer. That 20% cut is a dramatically better outcome for the postal agency than the two-thirds or larger reduction that Reuters reported last month Amazon had threatened. USPS warned last month it could run out of cash as soon as October, and the risk that Amazon would replace the carrier by expanding its own delivery network or using rivals was an existential peril. Amazon will continue its delivery expansion, but short of growth that would rival USPS's address-by-address reach, the sources said. Reuters first reported the deal. USPS has a roughly $80 billion budget, and Amazon represented $6 billion in annual revenue to the agency, according to two people familiar with the business arrangement. We're pleased to have reached a new agreement with USPS that furthers our long-standing partnership and will let us continue supporting our customers and communities together, Amazon said in a statement. USPS did not immediately comment. U.S. Postmaster General David Steiner told Reuters in December that USPS delivered about 1.7 billion packages annually for Amazon. Amazon had criticized USPS plans to auction off access to its last-mile delivery network. In April 2025, Amazon said it would spend more than $4 billion to expand its U.S. rural delivery network by the end of 2026. USPS said last month that it was seeking approval for a temporary 8% price hike for priority mail and package deliveries, effective April 26, to deal with rising transportation and fuel costs. Steiner said in March, hiking the price of a first-class stamp to 95 cents from the current 78 cents would help USPS cut losses. USPS has reported net losses of $118 billion since 2007, as first-class mail, its most profitable product, has fallen to its lowest volume since the late 1960s. Republican Clay Fuller wins the Georgia U.S. House runoff in MAGA stronghold, by Rich McKay, Jayla Whitfield Anderson, and Nathan Lane. From Ringgold, Georgia, Republican Clay Fuller, a former prosecutor endorsed by President Donald Trump on Tuesday, won a runoff election in Georgia to replace conservative firebrand Marjorie Taylor Greene in the U.S. House of Representatives, according to media reports. Fuller, a former district attorney in Northwest Georgia, defeated Sean Harris, a moderate Democrat who had been trying to win over disaffected Trump voters in the two-way race to represent the state's most conservative district. Tuesday's runoff was triggered after no candidate secured an outright majority in a March 10th special election held after Green resigned from Congress in January amid a public rupture with Trump. Harris, however, mounted a spirited challenge in a district that is heavily Republican. 2 years ago, Green defeated him by a nearly 30-point margin. With 86% of ballots counted, Harris had 42.5% of the vote and was trailing Fuller by about 15 points. Who would have ever thought that somebody who was endorsed by Donald Trump in a ruby-red district, that the race would be this close, Harris told supporters in a concession speech. Noting that Republicans had to spend time and money on the race, Harris added, "That tells you things are changing." Fuller's win gave House Speaker Mike Johnson a little more room to maneuver in pushing legislation through the chamber, as it currently is nearly evenly divided with 217 Republicans, 214 Democrats, one independent, and three vacancies. Josh McCoon, the chairman of the Georgia Republican Party, also noted aggressive Democratic spending. "All the king's horses and all the king's men could not turn Northwest Georgia blue," McCoon told a crowd of more than 200 people who were celebrating Fuller's victory. Scott Johnson, 69, a retail banking consultant from Marietta, Georgia, said Harris's vote tally was higher than he would like, wishing this was a clear blowout win for Fuller. "But we got our man in," he said. "A win is a win." A measure of Trump's influence. The special election drew national attention as a measure of Trump's influence in a district that became synonymous with the MAGA movement through its association with Green, one of his most vocal defenders before their split. Even with Harris's defeat, his performance will be scrutinized as an indicator of whether Democrats can continue to outperform in special elections, and whether high fuel prices and voter unease over the Iran war are shaping the electorate. Michael Bailey, a political science professor at Berry College, cited the district's history of easy Republican victories, including Green's 2024 win with 64.4% of the vote to Harris's 35.6%. But Bailey, whose college is in the district, said the margin of victory will be parsed for clues about party strength and Trump's standing with his MAGA base. One key marker, he said, was whether Harris could approach 45% of the vote. "If Harris gets to 45%, that's national news, in my opinion, because this is a heavily red district," Bailey told Reuters, saying such a result could prompt some Republican lawmakers to rethink their allegiance to Trump. "For Trump, above all, optics matter and perception matters," Bailey said. "If he isn't seen as having a magic touch, there's enough diversity with the Republican Party that there's going to be some people breaking away." Georgia's 14th congressional district is a mostly blue-collar corridor, stretching north from Atlanta's suburbs to the Tennessee border. Harris sought disillusioned Republicans. Harris, a cattle rancher and retired Army Brigadier General, sought to appeal to disillusioned Republicans with a campaign focused on inflation and policies aimed at supporting small farmers and veterans. He entered the race with a financial edge, raising about $4.3 million and reporting roughly $290,000 cash on hand as of the February 18th campaign finance filing. Fuller, who was a White House fellow during Trump's first term and is a lieutenant colonel in the Georgia Air National Guard, vowed to enact Trump's America First agenda. On his campaign website, he describes himself as a constitutional conservative with a tough-on-crime record. Fuller raised about $783,000 and had $238,000 in the bank as of February 18th. Fuller will serve through the end of 2026, but must quickly pivot to campaigning for a full 2-year term beginning in January 2027, starting with the party primary in May. The seat will be on the ballot in November's general election, when all 435 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and one-third of the Senate will be contested. Democrats are seeking to regain control of the House while facing steeper hurdles in the Senate. Relief at truce gives way to alarm as Israel pounds Lebanon and Iran hits neighbors. By Steve Holland, Parisa Hafizi, Alexander Cornwell, and Maya Shabili. Relief over a truce between the United States and Iran gave way on Wednesday to alarm that fighting was still raging across the region as Israel launched its biggest attacks yet on Lebanon and Iran struck Gulf neighbors' oil facilities. World financial markets rose after President Donald Trump announced the agreement late on Tuesday, 2 hours before a deadline he had set for Iran to open the blockaded Strait of Hormuz or face the destruction of its whole civilization. But even as Israel and the United States paused their attacks on Iran, Israel escalated its parallel war in Lebanon, launching its heaviest strikes yet, sending huge columns of smoke above Beirut as buildings crumpled. Lebanon's health minister said dozens had been killed and hundreds wounded. Residents said some of the Israeli strikes had come without the usual warnings for civilians to evacuate. Iran's Tasnim news agency cited an unnamed source, warning that Iran will withdraw from the ceasefire if attacks on Lebanon continue. Long after the ceasefire was meant to take effect, Kuwait, the UAE, and Bahrain all reported fresh Iranian missile and drone strikes, several of which targeted vital oil, power, and desalination infrastructure. Iran also attacked Saudi Arabia's huge east-west pipeline to the Red Seas. Just hours after the ceasefire was agreed, an industry source told Reuters, the pipeline is the main route by which some oil has been able to bypass the blockaded strait. Talks could take place in Pakistan. Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif said he had invited Iranian and U.S. delegations to meet in Islamabad on Friday, and that Iran's president had confirmed Tehran would attend. With several of Iran's veteran political leaders killed in the war, Iran's delegation is expected to be led by Parliament Speaker and former Revolutionary Guards Commander Mohammad Bakir Khalibaf with Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. Trump told the New York Post that in-person talks would happen soon, but said his Vice President J.D. Vance might not attend because of security concerns, contradicting media reports that Vance would lead the U.S. delegation. Despite concerns over the durability of the ceasefire, Brent crude, which had risen by more than 50% since the war began, was down around 15% on the day at $94.50 a barrel. U.S. stocks jumped to near one-month highs, joining a major global relief rally. Though both the United States and Iran declared victory, their core disputes remain unresolved, with each sticking to competing demands for a deal that could shape the Middle East for generations. The Strait of Hormuz remained shut. A senior Iranian official involved in the discussions told Reuters Tehran could open it on Thursday or Friday ahead of peace talks. Any opening, however, would be conditional on agreement over a ceasefire framework and would be limited, with ships still requiring Iran's permission to pass. In a flurry of online posts, Trump announced new tariffs of 50% on all goods from any country that supplies arms to Iran. He insisted Iran had undergone regime change and would agree not to enrich uranium, which can be used in nuclear warheads. The United States will, working with Iran, dig up and remove all of the deeply buried nuclear dust, Trump said. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Washington had won a decisive military victory and that Iran's missile program had been functionally destroyed. Iran's ruling establishment survives. Crowds took to the streets of Iran overnight to celebrate, waving Iranian flags and burning those of the United States and Israel. But there was also wariness that a deal would not hold. Israel will not allow diplomacy to work and Trump might change his view tomorrow, but at least we can sleep tonight without strikes, Alireza 29, a government employee in Tehran, told Reuters by phone. The war was launched on February 28th by Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who had announced they aimed to prevent Iran from projecting force beyond its borders, end its nuclear program, and create conditions for Iranians to topple their rulers. But so far, Iran retains both its stockpile of near-weapons-grade highly enriched uranium and its ability to hit its neighbors with missiles and drones. The clerical leadership, which faced mass protests months ago, has withstood the superpower onslaught with no signal of internal collapse. And Tehran's newly demonstrated ability to cut off Gulf energy supplies through its grip on the strait, despite decades of massive U.S. military investment in the region, could reshape Gulf power dynamics for years. The enemy, in its unjust, illegal, and criminal war against the Iranian nation, has suffered an undeniable, historic, and crushing defeat, Iran's Supreme National Security Council said. Netanyahu's office said Israel supported the decision to suspend strikes on Iran for 2 weeks, but the agreement is a blow for the Israeli leader, who has repeatedly said he wanted Iran's rulers to fall. Yair Golan, a former Israeli military deputy chief of staff, called the outcome a complete failure that endangered Israel's security. The nuclear program was not destroyed. The ballistic threat remains. The regime is still intact and is even emerging from this war stronger, he wrote on X. Iran war will leave lasting scars on the energy market. Commentary by George Hay. One day after warning of the end of Iranian civilization, Donald Trump has proclaimed a big day for world peace. The U.S. president's declaration of a 2-week ceasefire to his war with Iran caused oil prices to plunge nearly 15% to $94 a barrel on Wednesday morning as investors priced in the prospect of ships once again sailing through the Strait of Hormuz. But even in a best-case scenario, the scars from over a month of extreme trauma in the energy market will remain visible for years. For a start, the ceasefire is tenuous. Exactly how Iranian and U.S. armed forces will flip from fighting to working together to ensure tankers can safely navigate the narrow waterway, which previously handled a fifth of global oil supply, is unclear. Iran has an incentive to limit shipping volumes to maximize its negotiating leverage, while any big U.S. vessels in the Gulf will be big potential targets. Tehran's demands, including lifting of all sanctions, financial compensation for war damage, and the right to continue to enrich uranium, will also be hard to square with what Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu require to show that their war has been strategically worthwhile. But even if the president and his counterparts in Tehran agree on everything, a return to the pre-war status quo when a barrel of oil changed hands for about $70 faces multiple obstacles. First, the damage to Gulf energy infrastructure has been profound. Qatar has said Iranian attacks knocked out 17% of its liquefied natural gas capacity for up to 5 years. Second, those facilities that escaped attack have shut in production after filling up local storage facilities in the absence of shipments. Big producers such as Saudi Arabia will likely hold back on a return to full production until they have more confidence that the ceasefire has legs, a stance echoed on Wednesday by shipping giant Maersk. It could take up to 4 months for a degree of normalcy to return, one oil investor told Breaking Views. A third factor is that countries will need to refill oil reserves that they've been running down for the last month, while some governments will now want to hold bigger buffers. This will raise global demand for crude oil. Iran's plan to charge ships a toll for safe Hormuz passage, as reported by the Associated Press, will also push up prices. If Tehran charged a $2 per barrel fee on the daily flow of 20 million barrels, it would pocket almost $15 billion a year, and potentially much more. Finally, oil investors will likely add a $10 a barrel generic risk premium to the price of the black stuff to reflect the possibility of renewed fighting. Even if the U.S. and Iran now end their 5-week conflict, the global energy market will bear lasting scars. Trump will pursue stability with China's Xi in May meeting, USTR Greer says, by David Lauder and Doina Shiaku. The U.S. economic and trade relationship with China is stable, and President Donald Trump will aim to keep it that way in a meeting next month with Chinese President Xi Jinping, U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer said on Tuesday. What we are not looking for is massive confrontation or anything like that with China, Greer told an event hosted by the Hudson Institute think tank. Greer said the world's two largest economies have settled into a stable situation in which the United States is able to access Chinese rare earths and maintains substantial tariffs on Chinese goods. When we think about what to expect for the president's meeting, we're looking to maintain that stability. We're looking to ensure we can continue to get rare earths from the Chinese. Greer, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, and Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng discussed issues involving rare earths in Paris in March, including minerals that go through third countries before they make it to the United States. Although an initial Trump-Xi summit in Beijing was postponed due to the Iran war, Greer said that minister and staff-level consultations on rare earths have continued. It would be nice not to have it come up at the leaders' meeting, Greer said of the rare earths issue. It'd be nice if we could resolve it at the minister's level and the staff level, and hopefully we're in a position to do that. But of course the president, as he has in the past, will continue to advocate for U.S. access to rare earths. Greer said the United States is working on plurilateral agreements to boost alternative supplies of critical minerals, but these need price floor mechanisms to protect production from potential future predatory price cuts by China. Both countries should work together to implement what has already been agreed by their leaders, injecting greater stability into bilateral economic and trade cooperation, Mao Ning, a spokesperson at the Chinese Foreign Ministry, told a regular news briefing. Trump has said he would be open to the idea of Chinese electric vehicle maker BYD starting a plant in the United States, but U.S. lawmakers have voiced increasing concern that allowing such investments from state-supported Chinese automakers would create an existential threat to the market-driven economies of the American auto industry.